Ladies and gentlemen, we are pleased to inform you that the Eurostar number 9015, leaving at 9:30 to London Southwest, is now ready for boarding at platform number 4.
Hello and welcome to the No Code World Radio podcast. I'm Alex, your host, and this is the season 4. I'm going to London to explore the city. I've lived there for 2 years, so it's a city I know quite well. But I haven't been since COVID, so I really want to take the chance of this little trip to see what's happening there in terms of no code. Obviously, I know and I can imagine there is going to be a lot of interesting people to meet. And I've been all over Twitter and all over my networks to try to find the most interesting people. So I have planned a few interviews, and each of them will be an episode on that season 4. The first person I had the chance to meet in London was Dominic Norton. Very interesting maker. I could see straight away from his Twitter profile that we would have a lot to talk about. Let's go for the interview. Hi, Dominic. Thank you for having me here in London today and so spend a little time with me to answer questions for my podcast. Can you just introduce yourself a little bit so we can start?
Sure. I'm Dominic Norton. I am a no-code educator, content creator, and social entrepreneur. I am probably most famous for my project Missing Black People, Built with Softer. Missing Black People aggregates missing people appeals onto one centralized website. Since starting the project 2 years ago, we have conducted research, campaigns. We now work with the police and work with the government. So that's really, really interesting. I'm really passionate about social impact projects. But also, I have a startup called Prolific. And Prolific helps reduce software license waste by upskilling professionals. So I try to avoid the word citizen developers, but we're really trying to turn professionals into citizen developers. For you as a professional, we can help you hit your career goals, get career advancement, more money in your careers. But really for the business, we're helping reduce software license waste. So Microsoft Teams, Notion, Airtable, there's lots of tools these corporations are purchasing, which actually are not getting used. And this is why corporations come to us.
That's very interesting. Already a few things I'd like to talk about. But my first question is like, why do you don't want to use the citizen developer word?
Yeah, outside, so in the no-code world, especially when we're all talking to each other on Twitter and Slack and these different channels, it seems like our world is so big, but it's really not. And even within the no-code space, you have sub-ecosystems of bubblers and Notion ambassadors and Notion enthusiasts. But it's really a very, very small world. The idea, even the word no-code, turns people off. And I'm talking like quote-unquote regular people, it turns them off. And citizen developers is just still not a very popular word in the everyday person's lexicon. So I try to avoid using the word citizen developer. On the other hand, do argue there's lots of people that are citizen developers without actually knowing they're citizen developers. But we try to avoid the word because it's still not a friendly word or a sexy word for a lot of people.
It's do you feel like, because I have the same thing, I don't like to use it. Also because I think it's quite a strong statement. I think citizen really means something. And what I don't like, at least in France, but I'd be curious to know if you have the same, it's very used by enterprise-graded tools to describe in big corporations people who are going to use those tools. And this doesn't reflect, you know, the no-code community or what I think is a citizen. You know, a citizen is not someone in a big corporation, so...
Yeah, I would argue the same too. I think you highlighted something really important and something we're seeing right now in real time with tools like Bubble and Glide, and lots of tools are actually making an adjustment in the language they're using and the kind of audience they're trying to target. There's a lot of, they're moving more to the agencies and more to the enterprise where AppSheet has always been, or Mendix has always been, and I think it's Honeycode with Amazon, and they're trying to move to more that audience. But I agree with you, in certain spaces, they use the term citizen development. But again, I still feel with the average professional that citizen developer or citizen development word is still not very common. Where I do think it has come into play, there's reports by, I'm trying to remember the names, there's reports by big consulting firms that use it. Mm-hmm. And they use, there's lots of statistics, lots of great reports to show the rise in citizen developers. And I think they're trying to push this kind of terminology and this kind of language, but still doesn't resonate with the majority of people that are professionals.
Yeah, no, I agree. We might come back on this later. What's just to know a little bit about your background, how you arrived to the Snooker Tools?
Sure. So the story, when I'm teaching, the story I actually tell doesn't start from my university career or even my professional career. I usually start a lot earlier in my life. So when I was very young, the popular, and this is, you'll be able to tell how old I am by me just saying this, but when I was very young, MySpace was the most popular one. So you could say not that old, I'm a little bit old and getting there, but not quite there yet. And MySpace had customizable layouts, if you can remember. Mm. So you can customize the HTML and CSS. And at the time, I didn't know that was coding. And I wanted money, especially as a young student. I wanted to buy chicken and chips, which is a big thing over here in London. And at my school, other students would give you money to create custom layouts. Not much, £1, £2, nothing, nothing groundbreaking.
Yeah.
But is that's kind of what got me into it. And I loved doing it. And now we will probably call that low code. I'm not sure if you call HTML or CSS quite coding, but now we can kind of put that in the code/no code category. And at the time, I really developed an enthusiasm for doing it. I also used Dreamweaver. I'm not sure if you remember Dreamweaver, which was what? Relatively early in the visual programming. I don't even think it was called visual programming then.
Yeah, but it is definitely.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. A lot of the names have changed and the definitions have changed, but it's all pretty much the same thing. And over time, I think I left a lot of technology because I was an athlete. So I played sports more and more. I played basketball for the national team here. I went to America on a scholarship playing basketball. Nice. So I was really dedicated to sports. It wasn't until I got to university that I revisited technology. I was an architecture and construction student, and I never felt quite right in either. So architecture was really heavily design-based, and construction was really heavy field-based and really technical, but I was somewhere in between. And my professor said, hey, you should check out AEC, so Architecture and Engineering Construction, which is like a whole segment involving building information modeling, virtual design construction, where you're doing a lot of high-tech stuff, but it's high-tech in a way that non-programmers can do it.
Yeah.
And that's what really opened my eyes again. I ventured into the AEC field in construction and architecture, and I was introduced to 3D printing, I was introduced to laser scanning, I was introduced to augmented reality and virtual reality. And for anybody that's been in an architecture program or similar, you basically get given projects to do, and it's very, very time sensitive. And especially when I wanted to do a lot of augmented reality and virtual reality things in my project, I had to try and find ways to do that a lot quicker to actually submit my project on time. And this is where visual programming and no code and low code started to come in play. Before I even knew that was like a thing, a lot of these tools in the architecture industry have plugins you can use to turn rendering or your plans into an augmented reality experience. You can add additional logic to it using visual programming, you can add scripting, but this is kind of my early entry before I actually knew what no code and low code was.
So it was very applied to the field of construction.
100%, very, very applied to the field of architecture, engineering, construction.
It's interesting because I feel like there is a lot of similarity, if I mean, say it simply, but between like building a house and building a digital project.
Most definitely. And I think maybe that's a skill that, even though I'm not in the architectural field now, that's a skill that carries over into everything I do. The way I think about the sequence of a project, A has to be done first, then B, then C. What are the dependencies? What do I need to have? What do I need to know? Basically, the way I think about projects, you could say my training in architecture has really helped that.
It's like making a plan.
Exactly.
It's interesting because I feel like it's something that lacks some of the people in the no-code community, because all those tools we're using, and we will talk more about them, are very easy to use. And so you want to get your hands on it. But so people forget about planning and thinking about what they're going to do. You know, it's like, okay, I can do all this in Bubble, so I'm going to do it straight away. But I'm not going to think about, okay, I want to do it this way. You know, it's like, especially people who don't come from like this digital work. And
So maybe there's a thing there, you know, in the investment community or an investor community, they talk about the difference between a first time founder and a second time founder. Maybe there's something in the space about being a first time maker versus a second time maker. Now, I'm at the point now where I've built so much that I know exactly what tools I want to use. I know exactly the outcome. I've kind of gone up, and now and again I would create hobby projects, but usually I want to create a project to generate revenue, and I know the exact things that I need to do, or the exact ideas that are like people will actually pay for, because there's a difference between a cool idea and an idea someone says, I'm going to give you money for. And that's kind of what you develop as, I guess, a second time maker or a maker, in that where you've gone past the phase of being excited to build, and now you want to actually maybe build a successful business and not just a interesting product.
Okay. Yeah, I guess the experience gives you, it's becomes more and more simple to start thing, to have, like, you already have a plan very quickly in your head. Yeah. You don't have to lay it down. So how did you go from, or maybe let's say, what are you doing now? What's your job or work, or what's, you know, what you're doing with those no-code tools, and how you went from uni to this? Or?
Yeah, so from uni, I've done a combination of both. A lot of people, younger generations, especially nowadays, are really heavy entrepreneurship. I actually really do like the corporate life and the corporate environment, even though it's very, very difficult for a lot of people now. I think the challenge is finding the balance. And I think throughout my life, I've been able to find somewhat of a balance between the corporate roles that I've had. So for the most part, I've been a product manager in different sectors, in cybersecurity, in generally speaking, the software sector, like different sectors. I've been a product manager, but I've also been able to dedicate time to my own projects. A part of that is being able to be efficient. Sorry. Part of that is knowing the tools. So I don't actually spend a lot of time learning the tools. I know what tools I like for what purposes. So if I have time on a weekend, I'm not spending the weekend trying to figure a tool out. I can actually get to building. Yeah. More importantly, I can get to marketing whatever I'm working on. But it's that balance between corporate and entrepreneurship, especially if you're in your early stages. I think that can be one of the most difficult things, but I think that can be one of the most fruitful things, because even if you have a side project, you need a way to fund your side project. And the easiest way is to continue to use your corporate role, even if it's reduced hours, maybe part time. And it doesn't, I say corporate, it can be, there was a phase I was delivering for Amazon. I'm actually very, very bad at that. But there was a phase I had that role, and it was helping fund my entrepreneurship ventures and trying to figure out, okay, what am I going to do?
It puts less pressure on earning money from your side projects to have like a job or something. So yeah, I agree. It's one way to do it. Sometimes I think the bad effect of that is that you take too long to make money out of your project. You know, you might keep... It's like one, your job is sponsoring your project, but it's not, doesn't make efficient. But I feel like you find some recipes, kind of, I would say, I don't know, maybe it's not the right word, but to start a project, because you already you talk about marketing straight away,
yeah,
which I think is very important. A lot of people think it's about technical stuff, but I don't think it is really.
No. No, and that's what I found. We talk about balancing corporate and entrepreneurship, and there's just a lot of stuff in the financial world I don't actually like to touch on. And I said I don't like to touch on in the financial world, or if you follow financial creators, they talk about having multiple revenue streams. And as a creator, I've found that I don't like to touch on it. I feel it's unrealistic for a lot of people. But as a creator, especially if you're great at a no-code tool, let's say Bubble, let's say you have your corporate role, you're building your side project, and maybe you teach a Bubble workshop. Maybe you have a Bubble online course. Maybe you're doing some consulting too. Maybe you're doing some freelance work as well in Bubble. And this one, talk about the multiple revenue streams. You don't need to be doing all of them at the same time. But if you, I don't know what your expenses are here, it might be $1,500 a month. You have to figure out whatever you have to do to sustain your project, side project, you need to get $1,500 a month. So if you're going to combine that with your corporate, plus doing Bubble workshops, plus maybe one freelance project, okay, that's going to help you sustain the get the $1,500 a month so you can work on the side projects.
I guess it's all a matter of maybe at first, like the corporate role is going to bring most of it, and then slowly decrease while you're building your course. Then exactly. The course starts selling, you don't have much to do, and then you can take on a client, and then, you know, it's...
Exactly.
Yeah, no, it's...
And it's not a journey. A lot of people don't tell you, like, you're not going to figure it out. You're not... And some people might... I do a lot of workshops. I like doing the workshops. Some people might not like doing the workshops at all. I'm not the biggest... I do freelance projects. Not the biggest fan of doing a freelance project. Like, I have to have, like, the right client. And I'm very, very picky on who my clients are. Like, we have to work together and be able to sit and have a great conversation together. So I don't just pick up any freelance project.
I think everyone should be picky, but it's also a bit of a luxury.
Yeah,
but
exactly, it's definitely a luxury.
It's but again, as you're saying, I think it's a luxury that you can gain from not only doing freelancing, but also maybe a course. Maybe you don't sell many of them, or maybe a workshop. I think teaching is generally, if you're good at it, because not everyone, you know what you're saying, not everyone is good at doing workshops, but something also you can learn and you can do it. And it's pretty easy. A couple of hours, you do it, you have a little bit of money. And then on the side, you can choose maybe the right client or...
Yeah,
it's a mix of all this. I think it's interesting, but yeah, let's talk about those projects, and also maybe. So you did, and you talk a lot about on your in your content about hackathons. Are you doing side projects because you did a lot of hackathons, or is it the other way around, or is it?
It's probably a mix. It's definitely probably a mix, and. There are writers and there are musicians that talk about finding your voice when you're writing or doing music or being an author. And I think it's the same thing as an indie maker. I think you have to go through a lot of projects to find your voice. Do you like B2B? Do you like B2C? Do you like certain industry verticals? I'm probably industry agnostic, so I don't actually care what industry it is. I do prefer B2B, but B2C has served me in ways in terms of like thought leadership and branding and awareness. People see my projects, now they reach out to me for consulting or for jobs. So all of that was a part of the journey, but I had to find my voice as a maker and also what I know works for me and what I know doesn't work for me. In the entrepreneurship ecosystem, they have something called founder market fit. And there's certain industries that align with my brand, that align with my personal story, that just make sense. There's certain industries it will be very hard for me to venture in, even if I had an amazing idea, just because there's not really found a market fit with the project and the market and who I am.
Mm. Okay, and so do you want to share maybe some things you've learned, like participating in those hackathons?
Yeah, so I will combine the hackathons and probably general side projects. So I've put side projects into a couple buckets, and I would actually recommend other people doing a similar thing. One of the things I started with early was social impact. If you are any decent at no-code, low-code, you're going to see in your local community, whether it's France, whether it's England, no matter where it is in the world, some issue that you're like, oh, I think I can help this a little bit. Even if it's like Airtable and Softdoor or Glide, like something really simple. And what that does is not just fulfills like your social impact side of you, but there is like some branding and business savvy to it. The media usually love social impact projects, whether it's about climate, you name it. They usually love it. So it's easier for you to actually get those press releases. And those press releases will actually help. Let's say you launch an actual startup. It actually helps that, because you can say, hey, I was featured in TechCrunch and Forbes and wherever. And now you have the social proof as an entrepreneur, as a maker. Another way that it can help is grants. So we mentioned a little bit about generating revenue, and we mentioned more outside the social impact space, but inside the social impact space, there is a lot of opportunity to get grants, especially with the lack of technology capacity and knowledge. So for us indie makers, for us no-code and low-code enthusiasts, there's lots of things that's really easy for us to do that they can't actually do internal to, you could talk about homelessness or food poverty, no matter what the social issue, chances are we can come in and alleviate some of the problems relatively easily. And there's grants to be able to actually do that. So with my Missing Black People project, we do work with other big national charities, we do work with the police, but we do get grant funding to be able to do initiatives, and that does help not just me as an entrepreneur sustain myself, but it helps the project in of itself. There's another project that I think, or another bucket, which I think is more like trends and popular culture. And this is great for marketing. So if you have an agency, you're doing your regular agency work, but sometimes there's a small side project that you can do that can really drive interest. I like to lean on holidays. So for example, in February, I made a Valentine's Day project, and that Valentine's Day project was a AI love letter generator. So you write, I miss you. You can say, do you want it as a text message, as a Tinder message, as a, I think I had two other options there, and it will write a long, really romantic message based on I miss you. And that's the type of like, that in itself is not going to generate you any money, but that is the type of project, especially in a B2C project, that people are going to latch on, and they're going to use it a couple of times. They're not going to use that the whole year, but it's projects like that where you can lean on it, or you might see something that's in popular culture. Maybe if I had more time, I probably would have done this. You can make something off the back of Barbie was a huge hit. You could have made a Barbie related project that's not going to go on for years, and it might not even be a good business, but it can generate some social proof about you as a maker or you as a creator. And
it can be fun to do also.
It's definitely fun to do. So those are great areas to experiment and learn, but I typically don't make those projects too big. So it has to be really, really small.
Like focused on really,
really
specific.
Can I do this in a weekend? If I can't do it, what I want to do in a weekend is too long. Can I do this in a day? If I can't do it in a day, it's too long. Unfortunate that it's just me and my missus. We don't have kids. But I'm aware a lot of the no-code community might have kids. They might...
So that's different pressure.
There's different pressure. So you have to condense whatever project you're trying to do into the time you have, which also makes it important to know what tools yeah. can actually do what you want it to do.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, let's talk about the tools. But I just wanted to add something. I think there's another good reason to do like what you're saying is also to learn those tools.
Yeah.
To learn a new feature, to learn, let's say AI is big now, you heard about it, you want to do something, like find an ID, and you gave great examples of how to generate IDs, I think.
Yeah.
To build something, and this maybe no one hears about it, but at least you build something and you learn something along the way. And I really like that. I also do
and
that.
And there's actually another point to that. So all of that goes in your portfolio. And we typically talk about portfolios for client projects. But I also mentioned about corporate. Regardless of your corporate role, whether you're a product manager or I don't know, going for a software role or whatever role, typically they like the stories of stuff you built and stuff you've done.
Mm-hmm.
And having those projects also demonstrates stuff you've done. It demonstrates how proactive you can be to learn something, to do something new, especially in companies where they may be using Airtable or the team may be using Airtable or they may be trying to push an initiative with Notion and just no one really knows it. And I'm seeing more and more of that as time goes on.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. So you're mentioning a few tools. What are your tools of choice?
So for Chrome extensions, I use Builder. I exclusively use Builder for Chrome extensions. Yeah. I have a lifetime pass. I don't think for Chrome extensions I've seen anything that's close to being matched to Builder. I know some creators are using Bubble to make Chrome extensions, but to me, Builder's designed for that.
Yeah, I saw in your, and I will share the links in the notes of the episode that you built several, like some of your side projects. I was not surprised, but it's nice because I think Chrome extensions are great, you know, and they are possible to build using Node tools. So
yeah, Chrome extensions, and this is important too. Like a lot of people think about the regular SaaS or maybe a mobile application. But you can make plugins. There's so many different things you can make. So many different ecosystems that you can build in. You can make Slack bots. Like there's so much opportunity there, especially if you're talking about making money. I think sometimes we do get stuck in the pigeonhole of the echo chamber of no code, but no code is really wide. For example, I'm not even sure if it's in my portfolio. I do know it's on one of my Instagram accounts. For games, I like Buildbox. So Buildbox, and I have been criticized because with Buildbox, it's almost like you're reskinning. I'm not sure if you know what skinning is, but basically it gives you the template. You can change the assets, add some additional logic, but the core game is similar to Maze Runner or similar to...
Yeah. You choose like a concept. Kind
yeah,
of, like
you a choose gameplay. A concept yeah. and you change. But I'm like, there's so many people making money doing that. Why don't you change that and adapt it for the French market? There's something specifically cultural to France. And this is where I think the power is for us as no-code and low-code creators.
It's not easy.
It's definitely not easy.
It's not technical, but it's like finding this cultural thing, maybe, or it can be quite
easy. But this is where I think you begin to apply your personal experiences, your knowledge of a particular industry to really be able to make something unique and special. Yeah, it might look like Maze Runner or it might look like, I don't know, Candy Crush, but it's Candy Crush specifically for a particular market where the music's different and the feel's different.
And even the visual assets.
And the visual assets are different. And to the audience, it's a different game because of the emotional connection to those assets.
And maybe also then it extends to the marketing.
Exactly.
Yes, yeah.
So that's Buildbox Gaming.
So you built some games?
Yeah.
And would you say, because I've known of Buildbox for, you know, it's like the one kind of no-code tool for building games, but I never tried it. And it felt not very easy to get in. How would you say like...
I felt it was okay. So I will create a spectrum or I'll add two more. Flow Lab is probably one of the easiest I use, or you can even get a little bit easier than that. MIT App Inventor is probably one of the easiest I use. At the other end, Unity is a very common gaming engine for big game developers.
Professional.
You're professional, but they also have no code features to them. So you can develop using visual programming. And I will say Buildbox is somewhere in between. It's okay. In between MIT app inventor and making simple, really, really simple games. And it's in between Unity, where you're making really, really complex games. So I wouldn't say it's the easiest, but with the result you get, you'll be pretty impressed, you know, with what you've done.
This is, I think, it's like probably, for what I understand, like the best ratio, like the quality of what you get.
Exactly.
With the effort that you put in.
Exactly.
To, like to try.
I'll use a good example is that that I mentioned about niche games. There was a client I was working with in the US, and she had an amazing concept of she wanted to teach. She was a Christian, and she wanted to teach Christian stories, but to young people through gaming. And she made the game in Buildbox, and it was like an arcade game. But it was amazing. It was able to tell the stories. You had your character. The character was collecting religiously relevant, relevant. I want to say coins, but religiously relevant tokens, and fighting religiously relevant enemies. And the story was just perfect. And this is what I'm talking about, like applying like your personal experiences or interest for a very specific market.
Yeah, it's not about the technical aspect of it, but like the how you package it.
Exactly. And this is the thing about no code and low code, really, is when they say about democratizing, it's taken an abstraction away from that technical aspect and now focusing a lot more on the use case and focus on, okay, who's this exactly for? How are we going to connect the product to them? And this is the focus, and this is what I think the beauty is.
Okay. In terms of, we met through Claudia, who said hi to her, so from the No Code Ops community. Do you also, because we talked a lot about like building like products, like this kind of project or social impact project, but do you also work more in automation or like organization, like these kind of things?
Yeah, definitely. So one of my personal initiatives now is trying to find ways to automate the actual development of all these no-code, low-code apps. So I found ways to automate the idea generation. Okay. And I typically give OpenAI the framework that I use to generate ideas. And to give you a brief, it's no secret because I tweet about this all the time. So I might say something like, and all of this is automated. I usually use Make just for cost efficiency versus Zapier. I do like both. I think Zapier is better. I think Make is more cost efficient for me.
I agree.
But I would actually say something like, unbundle the fintech industry. And it will unbundle the fintech industry into crowdfunding platforms, peer-to-peer payments and all this. And then I say, write me ideas in the crowdfunding industry that integrates artificial intelligence. And it will generate 10 ideas. And one or two of them might be really interesting. And then I take that and I put that into another automation where it's generating me what screens I need, what backend database architecture I need, and trying to find ways to automate that whole entire process. And that's the current experiment that I'm running with automation.
That's interesting. So what would be the end game to that? Like building more things or have more choice and then choosing?
Yeah, building more things. What I mentioned, and maybe this is me explaining some of the madness if you follow me on Twitter, is I have a belief, and I'm not sure if you will agree with this, but I have a belief that 80% of ideas and applications and services are not original. And I have the belief, like, for example, if you're building a CRM, you're usually building a CRM that's already been built, but for a specific market, improving something else, specific demographic. And actually, an AI can generate that idea, and an AI can generate the specs, because actually not much has changed. As long as you give it the framework, it can create Amazon for, you know, India, or it can do all of that.
Yeah.
And typically people are coming up with the ideas thinking it's original, and it's not. And I have a theory that AI can do a lot of that, which actually means I can focus more on the marketing. And people are automating marketing, but I found marketing a lot, at least in me, in my process, marketing a lot harder, dealing a lot more with people and like that interaction.
We're talking about a lot about this, all this AI. Is it going to make people lose their jobs? Like, for instance, marketing, I think, is a good example. A lot of people are afraid that, okay, like, everything is going to be generated now. Would you say it's true? I mean, or what's your vision? I mean, because no one knows really what's going to happen, but...
I think the best way to use AI is to augment your process. So regardless of what profession you're in, if you're a marketer, you can use AI to generate marketing ideas. And again, out of 10 ideas, so give you an example, I write lots of articles. So for a following article, I'm trying to think of an article I wrote. I wrote recently about WorldCoin and the ethical impacts of WorldCoin and what Sam Altman's doing with that. And I would give ChatGPT the title and say, hey, I wrote an article about WorldCoin and this is the title. Generate other ideas for articles related to this article, but different. And it will generate 10 ideas. And one or two might be interesting. I'll say, oh, let me research more about that one. And that has inspired other articles. Mm. So I use it as like conversation rather than copy and paste.
Yeah.
Copy and paste, the people that do that are not going to be around long. They're not going to last in any industry.
Yeah.
But I think AI is a great thought partner to be able to converse and generate ideas and go back and forth.
Mm. No, I totally agree. I think good marketers, especially marketing, because I've seen it as in a lot of examples being used as, you know, like a job that's going to disappear. I think it's so much human. That's what you were saying. Like there is so much like the culture, there is the humor, there's so many different things that come into it that I don't think AI can replace. It can replace bad marketers or like very low level marketers. Just the same way no code is replacing very junior developers.
Yep. The issue that we have in every industry is everybody thinks they're in the top 1% of their field, which is just not true.
Yeah.
So like you said, AI can replace the bottom tier marketers, can replace the bottom tier software developers, like really across the board.
Yeah.
But the top, and especially the people that know how to use AI, it's unlikely that they're going to be replaced.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like if we see the other way around, like the top tier, they won't necessarily be replaced, but then they're going to be another hierarchy. It's like in the top tier, those people who are using AI, as you're saying,
exactly,
as an assistant, then they will keep staying in the top tier. Maybe the other one is going to go down, but that won't lose their job. But they just... But I think I'm starting to see more and more like talking about this, like kind of like using AI to augment your capacities, but it's not replacing you. And I think this is the right approach.
I haven't seen any articles of it named anything, but I do think it requires a different type of creative thinking where people call it prompt engineering, but I think there's more than that. Like you have to think about the conversation you're going to have with the machine to get the best output.
Yeah, I agree, because I think I never really thought about it that way, but prompt engineering would imply that you would, with one prompt, get the results straight away. And I really think it's the conversation.
It's the whole conversation.
That's why it's ChatGPT that changed the game. It's like,
sometimes I know just asking one or two questions, I'm not going to get the output I want. So I have to have a conversation before the actual question I want to ask.
That's interesting. Actually, I'm starting doing that as well. I'm very interested in all this. And I'm also starting to notice the size, you know, the number of tokens that the conversation can hold. And it's a bit frustrating. I hope this is going to expand, because sometimes you get to a point where your conversation is so long that it's starting to forget the beginning.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, it's going so fast, like the evolution, that we're going to see changes very quickly, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
No, it's all super interesting. Maybe, yeah, we didn't talk about it, but if you want to say a few words, you did the first fellowship of OnDeck.
Yeah, definitely.
The no-code fellowship, right? Yeah. So there are several fellowships. Can you explain a little bit what's OnDeck and what...
Yeah, OnDeck was extremely popular. It's still relatively popular. They decreased the size of the fellowships and decreased the number of the fellowships. But OnDeck was a cohort-based community. And I went through the no-code fellowship. I think they had angel investor fellowship, and they had different types of fellowships. But I went through the one, the no-code fellowship, where chances are, if you're watching somebody's no-code content, they probably came through OnDeck, or they're friends with someone through OnDeck. And it was a great community to be a part of, especially during COVID. And this is where these communities, and we mentioned Claudia and the no code ops community. These communities are essential because even in conversation, you're hearing about tools you might not heard before, hearing about workflows that you didn't even know were possible. And a lot of the conversation is important for your growth and personal development as a maker.
And yeah, no, I totally agree. So what are the other communities you're part of? So OnDeck is all online, right? It's international. It's not
I think they had a couple of cohorts they tried in person, but it's all online.
Okay. Yeah, because I feel like it really spiked during COVID, or did it exist before? I don't know.
So what's interesting, I think every generation or every year, every generation, you're going to have these type of cohort-based communities. Build Space is huge right now. You know, it was OnDeck.
It's in Web3, right? Build Space. No.
Well, I don't. I think they've actually changed it. I think they changed it to include everything. So musicians can come in if they need kind of a push to release their album or mixtape. It's not just tech related. No. It's kind of just like builders.
Okay.
Builders and makers. No. Hopefully I'm not getting it wrong and I'm just lying, but from my understanding, it's builders and makers now, and that's huge right now. And there's lots of people in my community that are part of Build Space right now. 100 days of no code. So that's 100 days of no code is a pivotal community in the no code community. For those that don't know, it's a challenge to do really, really small projects every day, every week for 100 days. And what it does, it teaches you all these different platforms, all these different tools. And by the end of the 100 days, you should know enough to be able to make whatever you want to make using a range of different tools.
I'm hoping actually to interview Max, in a few days. So yeah, hopefully get the full story of that. But yeah, I think it's this 100 days of no code. I've seen people in France doing it.
Yeah,
I don't think I know anyone in France. There must have been. I mean, I don't know everyone obviously, but that went through OnDeck. But 100 days of no code, because I really like the format. It started literally just with a hashtag.
Yeah.
Do it, and I'm going to do it. And then everyone started, and then he built a sort of business around it. And I think it's a great way, it's a quite creative way to start. So, but yeah, that will be for another episode. Last question. We're talking about communities, but what about the local, like more like London or the UK? Is there... I know there has been some no-code drinks in London. Yeah. I don't know if you've been part
Yeah,
of that
I've been
or...
to Charlie's Indie Beers. So it's indie makers / no-code, low-code, but probably more indie makers. Yeah. Indie Beers, there's another community. I can't remember the name of it. There's another community I go to where, again, it's drinks and talking about marketing and creating projects and really interesting things in the space. Funny enough, you would think in London there'll be a lot more. There's not a significant amount. We do have Notion ambassadors here, and sometimes there's Notion events. I believe we have some Webflow leaders, and there's Webflow events, but there should be a lot more, but I think also we have to keep in mind the economic times and everything going on right now.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think historically London was the biggest city for startups.
Yeah.
And in Europe, I mean, but then COVID, and maybe, I don't know, maybe the Brexit, I don't know how this impact, yeah. I'm curious to know what you would think about that, but has kind of slowed down compared to maybe Paris or Berlin. I'm not just talking about no code, but like even in startup, in Paris, we have this massive incubator, Station F. Berlin has been also very active. So I don't know what's your...
It's hard to tell because you have to put what's happened in the UK in context of like everything from, well, really, you can take it from before Brexit, but let's just say from Brexit, I think leaving the EU has negatively impacted the entrepreneurship ecosystem in the UK, not just London, in the UK. I think the changes in government and turmoil is probably the right word, but political turmoil in the UK is challenging for entrepreneurship, it's challenging for investors, it's challenging for businesses, changing regulatory environments. We had the whole phase of crypto and the rise of crypto, the fall of crypto, the rise again of crypto. But the UK has taken strong stances on things blockchain related, is starting to take strong stances on things AI related, trying to figure out what that means. Obviously, I'm from the outside, but it seems like countries like France have it more figured out when it comes to where they stand with entrepreneurs and entrepreneurship and building the capacity of their businesses locally.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, there could be a lot to talk about France and entrepreneurship. But the only thing I can think of like regarding AI is maybe because those things are discussed in Europe in general, maybe it's a bit easier for Europe because you have all those different countries that are giving their ideas while, let's say, Britain is alone facing this AI. How do you react to that? And so it's all about all your government. While in Europe, we have this European Parliament, we have all kinds of... So more political aspects are, I guess, merging. And I feel like, I think the GDPR, for instance, was a good example of what a good thing that Europe can do, you know, and even impose it a little bit to the Americans.
Yeah.
I think in AI, they're talking about interesting things, although I think they are not very applicable, but... So yeah, this could be also different.
Yeah, definitely. I think, but also, I am curious to hear your views too. I've been active in vocalizing this on Twitter about communities and the platform's relation to communities. Mm. I don't think the platforms are always friendly to the community leaders and the content creators and really people that are strongly advocating. I feel like they can do a lot more, especially in major cities, to kind of drive a lot of that community engagement, because that's where a lot of the core movement for their platform comes from.
Yeah. No, yeah, this I can't agree more. I don't know if it's... I'm going to talk about just like no-code tools because that's what I really see the most and I think about the most. And I don't know if it's because of the economical environment, as you say, like it's, or it's because of the COVID put everything online, but I don't understand why all the major tools don't have a monthly meetup in the big cities in Europe, you know?
Yeah.
Or at least in London, maybe. So it's in English, it's easier because most of those platforms are American. In France, in Paris, we have a lot of people. It would be very easy to start a monthly Airtable meetup. But I don't know. No one is doing that.
And yes, it's interesting. It's interesting. And it's especially interesting for me because I used to go to the coding meetups, the JavaScript meetups, the Swift meetups, and this is how, especially when you're talking about open source, this is how the advocacy was built. And it's still built that way. Even like post COVID. So from a tech perspective, I've always known tech to be the hackathons, the in-person meetups. That's what I've known tech to be. And that's why I think you have people that are diehard TypeScript fans, and it's the meetups that are really like pushing that. like you mentioned, Airtable, I haven't heard of it in person, Airtable, and it might just be in like the circles I'm in. It might be a thing that I just don't know about.
They don't have, and honestly, I really like this tool. I'm a big Airtable fan. The tool itself, the company, I don't know. I don't have anything against them.
Yeah.
But they don't have an ambassador program. I mean, Notion has one, Webflow has one. Webflow has a pretty good one, I think.
Yeah,
They're really trying to help. Notion also, they're giving money to you so you can organize meetups, stuff like that. And I don't know. So yeah, I don't understand. They have tons of money. They raise so much money. You know, I think it's a business that's going well. So, and I think part of the reason you mentioned it at the very beginning of our talk is like when you talk about like those tools, like going more towards the enterprises. And it feels like they're not, because the makers, what you and me are part of this community, I think they're a bit disregarding it, because of course we make less business. We are poor users of the tool, but we don't generate for them a lot of money. Maybe some, of course, maybe we have clients. And so I think that's really a shame. And I honestly, I've seen that, I'm talking about Airtable, but almost all the tools have the same thing. And I don't know, I think it's a shame, because you should take care of your power users, even if they're not like the ones who are generating the most business, but they are the ones that are vocals about your tool. They are, so I don't know, I don't understand.
Yeah, it's, and I think most or all of them, are probably VC backed. And I am sure they're probably getting pressure by their investors to pursue a more B2B model. The challenge that I have is I don't think their platforms are necessarily designed for B2B.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned Mendix. Mendix is B2B.
Yeah, yeah.
Like even Google App Sheets. I think Google App Sheets is B2B. Mm.
Because it was designed that way from
the beginning.
It was
designed that way when it was just App Sheet, I believe. But it is designed that way. And there are others that were UiPath, B2B.
Mm. Yeah, that's true.
But designed that way. So this is the challenge I think they're facing.
Yeah, I totally agree on the VC impact, I think. I think we saw it with Bubble, for instance. Like they raised a lot of money, and I'm glad they did, because this gives them... But they also kind of changed their vision of being like this platform for everyone to use to, okay, like what we actually want is more... like the enterprises to use it, like the makers, you can still use it, it's fine, but we're more looking, and all the tools almost have made that they just don't show it in the same way. Some is more smooth or is more like clear, but yeah, that's business. And I think that's one thing that's going to be interesting at the NoCode Summit, in because it's an event that at first it was called the Low-Code No-Code Summit in last year. In the end, they changed it, I think, at the last minute. But the original project was to do Low-Code No-Code, because they wanted to have the low-code, like the Mendix, all those, also to be part of it because they have money.
Yeah.
But then if you bring those people, then you need to have, for them to be happy, you need to have in front like B2B, like enterprises, customers. Yep. But there were a lot of makers. And so, you know, there was this. So I don't know how it's going to be this year, because there's a lot of sponsors. There's a lot. Are they going to be happy with the, or are we going to be happy as makers to have, are we going to have a good time if it's a very B2B event? I don't know. I'm just curious.
It's interesting. But this is where we mentioned a little bit about citizen developers. Mm. I mentioned about upskilling professionals. I love doing the workshops with founders and entrepreneurs, but even for me, it's more lucrative doing with the businesses. Where my company specializes in, I mentioned that we upskill the professionals, but in approved software licenses. So a team might not be using Airtable, they might be using Salesforce. So there, as a head of procurement, or as a procurement manager, you don't necessarily, or even in the learning development department, you don't want the employee to be learning Airtable. You want them to be learning how to use Salesforce a lot better, because you're paying for all those licenses in Salesforce.
Yeah.
And this is where we focus on.
Okay. No, that makes sense. Yeah, no, it's. I think it's a good idea actually. Like this, like the way you presented, like this license waste, like yeah. to prevent that. I think it's.
But again, just like the no-code and low-code platforms are figuring out, you have to change your value proposition when you're talking about for B2B.
Mm. Yeah, and I think we're in the middle of this transition for some of the tools. And I think some other tools will show up and rise and be more for like the makers and like B2C. And I think we're still fairly early in this whole business. So it's quite interesting to see. Because I think in the long run, maybe we will see back some of those tools. They will make the right choice to pivot in terms of their targets and the business they want. But also maybe some, they will lose their original users, or I don't know, we'll see. It's
I think an interesting progression or interesting trend is worth watching is what I call text to template. So Flow have begun to do this. I think WeWeb have potentially begun to do this, where you, in natural language, you say, I want an e-commerce app that does this, and it makes the template for you.
Yeah.
And I think that is going to be more common over the next couple of years.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's quite exciting because you have the best of both worlds. You have the AI that makes like the beginning of the work, but then you don't have to code after.
Yeah.
Because right now, if you ask ChatGPT to give you the source code of an app, then for people who are not coders, you cannot modify what it's going to give you.
Yeah.
If you do it in WeWeb, for instance, then you have like the visual editor for web, and then you can keep building without coding. And this is very exciting.
But what we also actually see, I mentioned Flutterflow, you can export code, and also they have a native IDE. I would suspect that more platforms will move that way, where WeWeb, I think you can export code too. And I think more platforms are going to move that way, where you can export code and potentially even edit code natively.
That's interesting. I hope so, because it's the vendor lock-in is a big problem, and it's a big stigma, I would say, to the no-code tools. It's the first thing. Like if we talk to developers, they will say, you're locked with a vendor. And I think, this is the newer generation of tool, which like Flutterflow or WeWeb, I think, are getting away from this. Some tools are becoming no-code. Have you heard of Noodle?
No, I don't think I have.
I've seen some bubblers usually that are switching to that tool. I've never tried it, but it's also like a low code, no code platform.
Yeah.
But they are becoming open source.
Interesting. Yeah. So you mentioned something interesting that I just want to hone in on. I think a lot of the platforms have typically been geared for a particular market. We usually say, hey, this is for non-technical people, but usually that's broken into different categories. I think you mentioned developers, and developers usually be an anti-no-code. I think there's a branch of developers that are in favor of no-code, or usually more technical, non-technical people.
Mm.
So non-technical people that have the knowledge and capacity to do technical things. I think that's a specific category that some platforms are better designed for. Then you have the designers. I think, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Bravo Studio, where you can go Figma to app.
Mm.
I think there's services and tools that are specifically designed for designers to make apps. And I think you have these different categories that they focus on different kind of skill sets, where you can focus on your particular skill set and still go to a native app or still go to a SaaS platform.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's interesting to see what is going to survive and what's, because in all those categories, I'm not sure what's the big category that we know of is all the people who cannot code.
Yeah.
But it's like kind of the holy grail. Everyone wants to address that, but it's also the hardest, obviously. But then if you start focusing more, I think Bravo Studio is a good example, but. And I had a chance actually to interview Toby last year. But I don't know if they will survive, to be honest.
Yeah.
I think it's a great team. They have a vision, but they're also trying to address something quite specific, you know. And if they don't find the product market fit, I don't know. We'll see.
where I think all of them fail comes back to the tester template. I think, and I've been in developer communities long enough that I know there's some developers that like the process of developing, which is one thing.
Mm.
A lot of the people using no-code and low-code tools, there are people that do like the process of it, but most people just want the output.
Mm.
And if AI is going to just get us to the output, I think that puts in question everything before that.
It's true.
Because you speak to a client, they don't care. Some clients don't care.
Yeah.
Well, do you use this programming language? Do you use this no-code tool? They don't care. They just want the app.
Yeah. They might not even understand anyways.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The only thing they're thinking about is the ongoing maintenance cost. Or can I edit this when I want to edit this?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Super interesting. I mean, yeah, we could talk all night about all this. But yeah, this was also already really great. Thanks a lot for sharing all this. I have just one last question. It's not related to tech, but I'm just curious to know what's your favorite thing to do in London? What you would recommend to someone who comes but has a Londoner?
There's so much to do in London. What are you thinking about, you specifically or just...
No, just like what you like what you would recommend, like something a bit maybe not secret, but you know, something like not like the touristic stuff, like people will find out. But
I think London has really interesting bars. Like, obviously, you have the regular commercial bars, but there's themed bars where it's themed like 1920s or you know, these different kind of themes, really interesting jazz clubs and like mini concerts where it's in a small intimate setting. I think those are really interesting. But even without those, there's so much. Anything you want to do, you can do in London. Just be careful, it can get expensive.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Especially I think with the inflation.
Yeah, with the inflation it can get expensive. Yeah. Do it for a couple of days and then go back home.
Yeah, exactly. It's a great city. I really like it. If you had to, like, maybe one neighborhood, because one thing that I like about London is that there is so many neighborhoods. They each have their own identity. There is, I think everyone has a neighborhood that perfectly suits you. But
well, I'm an East London person, so I will say the Shoreditch area. The Shoreditch area is good. Even though it has been gentrified a lot, it has a unique personality. It has a lot of different things that people like to do. It has the music, it has the clubs. If you like dancing, it has salsa, it has lots of different things.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Perfect. Thank you so much for all this. Before I forget, I will put the links, but what are the best places to follow you and get in touch?
Yeah, the best places to follow me are probably TikTok, YouTube, or potentially Instagram or Twitter. So Dominic O'Norton on DominicOnorton. That's on Twitter. That is on Instagram. On TikTok, I'm Mr. Hackathon. So Mr. Hackathon. On YouTube, my YouTube channel is How to Build Software Without Coding.
All right,
Mr. Hackathon again.
Okay, cool. I'll put all the links. You have a link tree page and with all the side projects, it's perfect. So I will share that. Thank you so much, and let's talk soon.
Thank you.
What a great conversation with Dominic. I'm so glad I had the chance to meet him. And straight after this interview, I'm going to my next appointment. I saw on Twitter before coming to London that there was an event called No-Code Drinks, and I was very curious, and I could see it was organized by two people, Pierre and Veronica. So I got in touch with them, and Veronica agreed to meet me. But I need to be quick. I just have about 20 minutes to get to her. We're going to meet in King's Cross, so I'm going to head straight away. See you in the next episode.